Welcome to another talk from the Aspen Audio Library. Eloise Bell is a professor of English and associate dean of the Honors Program at Brigham Young University. Sister Bell filled a mission to France, and from 1973 to 1978, she served on the general board of the Young Women. Her newspaper column, Only When I Laugh, has been a perennial favorite among journalists and readers alike. Selections of this column are published in the book by the same title from Signature Books. The following presentation of Only When I Laugh was given at Brigham Young University.
In the Old West, a cavalry troop rides into a trading post that has obviously been hard hit by a band of Indian warriors. Buildings are burned to the ground, horses have been driven off. Everyone is dead except a lone agent who lies on the ground with a 6-foot spear through his chest. The army lieutenant leaps from his horse and rushes to the agent's side. "Good heavens, man," he says, "doesn't that hurt terribly?" To which the agent replies, "Only when I laugh." What I enjoy most about that old joke is its irony. The absurd premise that the skewered agent has, in fact, actually laughed while waiting for rescue, that he actually knows what it feels like when he laughs with the spear through him. For me, it is the ironies that give life its textures, its richness, and most of its fun. The paradoxes, the contradictions, the anomalies are not only interesting, but enormously enlightening. So when Network Magazine back a dozen years or so asked me to write a monthly column for them, it was predictable that I would focus on the ironies of being a woman, a Mormon, a Utah, an American in the last decades of the 20th century. I don't know how that view of the world would be received elsewhere, but as it turned out, quite a few other women and men in this area enjoy the tang of irony, and so my column, titled Only When I Laugh, has enjoyed encouraging response from our readers. Sometimes the ironies I look at are lighthearted, I hope not light-minded. They're frothy and of marginal importance. Other times the irony is darker and the issues more complex. John Sciardi, however, writes that anything significantly looked at is significant. Whether these pieces of mine, investigations into the ironies of the world around us, are significantly looked at is, of course, for you to decide. Certainly the Utah State vegetable, the zucchini, is an ironic item. The only garden produce which is more difficult to dispose of than to grow. I mulled that over in the following essay. It's amazing how often the simple truth in a cause and effect relationship is missed by an otherwise intelligent observer. For instance, a few years ago, the makers of Postum and Sanka looked into their sales reports and found an amazing peak in the Utah area. Excited by how well their products were doing, they sent a research analyst with a well-cushioned expense account to Utah with instructions to put in 6 weeks' research time in order to discover why the beehivers bought so much Postum and Sanka. I've always been curious as to what the analyst did for the 5 weeks and 6 days after finding the answer. Maybe fortune smiled and the assignment came during ski season. All this is by way of admitting that I have just recently come to understand why there are so many zucchini recipes in the world, and especially in this part of the world. Just the other day, I saw a pamphlet claiming to offer 100 recipes for zucchini. No, we don't have green bean cookbooks, do we? Or 100 wonderful ways with watermelon? We don't have recipes for radish bread or celery cake or cucumber soup. Yes, I believe there is such a thing, but no one carries on about it. You see, that's what stumped me, the way people carry on about the recipes. I have friends who greet the announcement of a new zucchini recipe with a great deal more excitement than anybody gave to the discovery of cold fusion. What am I saying? I know newborn babies who don't get the welcome a new zucchini recipe gets. And until recently, this reception always puzzled me. Did other people really find this nondescript little vegetable all that delicious? That they were ever on the watch for new and better ways to serve it? Was it really such ambrosia to them that they couldn't get enough of the stuff and vied with each other for more and more imaginative concoctions? Look, May, zucchini waffles! Hey, Alice, have you tried homemade zucchini ice cream yet? Listen, Deanne, take my word for it, zucchini oyster dip is terrific. In a way, it was like being colorblind. Apparently, everybody else in the world was seeing, or in this case, tasting, something that just didn't come through to me. I didn't especially dislike the stuff, but I was not about to vote for it to replace chocolate chip as the all-American dish. And then, as I was sitting in my office one day, gazing pensively, or perhaps just groggily out the window at majestic Timpanogos, the whole truth came into my mind, all of one piece, as the theory of gravity came to Newton. Eureka! There are so many zucchini recipes because...
there are so many zucchini!
Exactly! And why are there so many zucchini? Because apparently zucchini crops never fail. I hear tales of people running out on frosty nights to cover up their tomatoes. Tales of fruit farmers burning smudge pots to protect the apricots or peaches. I see people planting marigold borders around the vegetable garden to ward off the corn borer. But nobody seems to lose a wink of sleep over the zucchini. It seems to be the weed of the vegetable world. I may have told you about my non-gardening but devout Mormon friend who finally decided she should follow the counsel of church leaders and put in a garden. She tore up a portion of her plush backyard, tilled and harrowed, and then planted 4 rows of zucchini. 4 rows, long ones of zucchini. When in the fall she began showing up at our meetings with dark circles under her eyes, I asked about it. Seems she had been getting very little sleep since harvest time. Instead, she was making nightly forays out in ever-widening circles to deposit bushel baskets of zucchini with a few tomatoes on top as window dressing on the doorstep of neighbors, ward members, stake members, neighbors of relatives, relatives of neighbors. The last thing I heard, she was doing a midnight shuttle out Wendover way. Why do people climb mountains? Because they're there, we're told. And why do people plant zucchini? Because it grows. And because it grows so abundantly, people in this region will sell the family water rights to find yet one more way to use the darn stuff up. But I've heard of a group of women in East Salt Lake who may have licked the whole problem once and for all. It seems they have discovered a method of laminating zucchini. Do the possibilities ripple out before you? Zucchini coasters, zucchini napkin rings, zucchini playing cards. That'd solve the face card dilemma permanently for card-loving Mormons and bring an end to the nuisance of playing pinochle with rook cards. Zucchini earrings, bracelets, zucchini campaign buttons, zucchini picture frames. Why, we haven't even tapped the possibilities yet. Don't give up the zucchini. Ironies of zucchini. Well, and you know, fashion is certainly ironic. Every time I watch a televised fashion show with a long-legged, sullen woman parading in quick march up and down a runway, I cannot shake the conviction that they're all putting us on. And it's not just high fashion that's full of paradox. Ordinary, everyday streets of Utah fashion has its oddities. For instance, this happened in my local drugstore. I was prowling the aisles searching for some industrial-strength porcelana when I overheard two conspicuously well-groomed women talking by the cosmetic counter. "Well," said one, "I used to think I was an autumn, but then I found out that I was really spring." "Isn't that funny," replied the other. "I've always been a summer." Of course, I knew what they were talking about. I may be out of the mainstream as far as high fashion and new tech makeup are concerned, but I still paddle around the edges of the river and the ripples reach us all. These two shoppers were referring to a theory of clothes and makeup coordination that assigns each person a seasonal designation, depending, I assume, on one's basic skin tones, hair and eye color, and for all I know, blood type and urine analysis. If you are in autumn, you supposedly look best in certain shades and textures. If a spring, you look better in others and so forth. Now, my own method of wardrobe selection has nothing in common with matching up nature's seasons and my own. My categories are not winter, summer, autumn, and spring, but passable, shabby, disgraceful, and don't insult DI by making the offer. But I certainly don't pass judgment on those higher up on the gracious living ladder than I, simply because their standards are more esoteric. What I do question is the assumption that seems to accompany this approach to dress and grooming. The zealots I hear preaching the Four Seasons doctrine carry on as if these designations were ordained in heaven, or at least in the DNA, as if they were part of one's karma. The implication is that if you are an Autumn, and you mistakenly, or Edith Head forbid perversely, deck yourself out in the hues of a spring, you are subverting some master plan laid before the foundations of the world, and nothing will possibly go right in your life until you repent and get on the predestined course. Haven't we enough pressures in life without a new creationist theory breathing down our décolletés and checking the color of our undergarments? On the other hand, if there is anything to all this concept, why stop with the four seasons? I mean, let's extend the metaphor and use what's available. For instance, I haven't the foggiest idea whether, according to the ordained theory, I'm an autumn, winter, spring, or summer, and please don't tell me. I couldn't handle the responsibility of knowing. But I do realize that frequently I am Monday morning. My face tells me, my body tells me, my mind, whatever segment of it responds to roll call, tells me in no uncertain terms. Now, an enterprising entrepreneur might be onto a good thing if she put out a package of cosmetics and related sundries labeled Monday morning. Nothing elaborate, a sturdy tube of erase for the dark circles, a packet of aspirin, high-potency mouthwash, a small sign warning the outside world of your status. My own sign would read, Eloise Bell is closed. On the other hand, I know a couple of people who are clearly Saturday night, besides Bette Midler. These women wear false eyelashes, 4-inch dangling earrings, and see-through hostess skirts to change the kitty litter in the cat's box. They look more dressed up going to bed than I did when dining at Maxim's in Paris, borrowed fur and all. You can learn a lot about human nature by watching the encounter of a Monday morning and a Saturday night when their desks are next to each other in the office. Very different from Saturday night is Saturday morning. We all know a few Saturday mornings, don't we? Instead of sleeping in like other mental health conscious folk, these people are up arrogantly early, showered and shampooed and decked out in crisp sportswear that announce the morning's basic training, tennis or hiking, cross-country skiing, or a brisk 15-mile jog, and that's on Monday. You can imagine how unbearable these types are when it actually is Saturday. Then there's Sunday morning and Sunday afternoon. If you think they're twins, think again. Sunday morning is heels and pantyhose, a stylish go-to-meeting dress, and a sprinkling of a mighty fortress perfume. Sunday afternoon, late Sunday afternoon, is quite simply Monday morning slouching in the wings. And of course we know that some women are Mother's Day all year round. They wear big self-advertising corsages at all times. The fact that the corsages are invisible doesn't keep anyone from seeing them. I had an aunt once who was clearly Groundhog's Day. She came out of her burrow periodically, but invariably saw a shadow of some sort. It obviously didn't matter whose, and went right back into seclusion again. A friend in Logan is the 4th of July. Well, most of the time, anyway. In fact, her whole huge family is 4th of July, except, I believe, for one of the younger boys, who apparently is recess. I needn't tell you about the people who are April 15th. We all have a touch of that in us. I hear there's a new blusher out called Livid that would suit the April 15ers to a 1040. Phyllis Diller used to be a Halloween, but apparently she tired of that and changed to chemistry or something. And then there are my niece and nephews, Hillary, Chris, David, and Timmy, each of them an undisputable Christmas, at least to these biased eyes. The next time someone asks you what you are, forget about Taurus or Autumn. Tell them you're Friday afternoon and raring to go. Now, since I brought up the subject of clothes, let me talk a little about fashion from a feminist point of view. In other words, inequities in the wardrobe department. The subject I want to bring before the sisterhood today is not a major issue such as equal pay for equal work or the right to have credit cards in our names. It is admittedly a smaller matter, but one with considerable significance in the long history of our upward climb toward justice. It deals with precisely where we are going to put that equal pay and those credit cards when we get them. In a word, pockets. Pockets may well be among the most liberating of humankind's inventions. Just contrast the actions of a man and a woman writing a check, a small task repeated many times in the course of a month in our modern society. The man lightly lifts the lapel of his suit jacket a couple of inches away from his body, plucks from his handy inside pocket both checkbook and pen, and writes his draft. The whole transaction is a model of elegance, grace, and ease. What happens to a woman who needs to write a check? To begin with, the check is in her handbag. Thus, she must find a place to rest her bag while she opens it, unless she has become adept at the one-handed zipper trick. She could also try balancing her handbag on her bosom, but depending on the size of both, She will have a minimal to zero luck with that maneuver. Take my word for it. Once the purse is open, she has to locate the checkbook or wallet checkbook combination. She will pull out her appointment book, which is the same color, her address book, and her memo pad before dredging up the checkbook itself. Even then, her problems are not over. Does she leave the handbag open while writing the check? Well, why zip four times instead of twice? On the other hand, while she turns aside to write out 54 and 32 one-hundredths, someone may help himself to her cross pen or other goodies lying unprotected in the gaping purse. And even if that possibility seems remote, does she really want others waiting at the checkout counter to be treated to the sight of the full panoply within? On the other hand, if she's getting change back from the check, she'll have to have access to her coin purse or the billfold section. What she usually ends up doing is jamming everything, checkbook, pen, bills, receipts, and loose change back in a wad, grabbing her groceries and leaving with the handbag still yawning open and dribbling its contents as she goes. 'Tain't funny, McGee. Yet women's unliberated plight in this respect has long been the source of male jokes. The size and content of handbags and abundance of other pieces of luggage that women traditionally carried evoked many guffaws and cartoon put-downs during the Victorian era, and the laughter goes on. In earlier stage and movie comedies, at least one woman would show up on the scene laden with huge handbag, needlework bag, parasol or umbrella, hat, bag, and shawl, not to mention shopping bundles. Often she would be trying to get in or out of a door, on or off a bus or tram. And if she were traveling on a train, easily a dozen other pieces would be added. At a women's history conference in Minnesota, I heard a fine paper analyzing the various items advertised as women's luggage in the Sears Roebuck catalog of 1910. More than 50 separate kinds of baggage were included, each with a distinct and different purpose, most of them unknown to us today, thanks be for small favors. The point is that even when traveling, women were and still are, to a lesser degree, laden with the trappings assigned to the keeper of the goods. The 19th century woman was everywhere encumbered, anchored, and burdened. Women of our century are not yet out from under. The answer to less burdensome handbags is, in part, pockets. Why do women not have pockets, and why should we want them? We want them because they are freeing. They free the hands, enabling us to stride through the world unfettered. With both hands free, we can pull open a heavy door with some grace and ease, instead of going through a vaudeville routine. We can grab a railing or swing onto a bus. We can catch ourselves more easily if we stumble. We can shake hands or embrace someone without a juggling act. Obviously, the arms are meant to swing free as the human being walks, so as to provide grace and balance. What a 15 or 30-pound handbag does to that balance, we all know too well. Yes, we do need to throw a good bit out from what makes up those 15 pounds. But then we need to have a few handy pockets for the rest. Without them, we earn an undeserved name for carelessness. For example, whenever I leave my office, I lock it. Thus, I must carry my keys. I usually carry a pen because writing notes and memos and signatures is a continual part of my work. I often carry a couple of pieces of paper. Now, when I wear a suit coat with jacket pockets, then these little items slip into a convenient repository. Few of my clothes have pockets, however, so I usually carry everything in my hand. I refuse to walk around the corridors of my building carrying a purse. When I use my hands, as I quite often do, I must put these items down someplace. Then if I become engaged in what I'm doing, if someone involves me in a conversation, if I start thinking about the next matter at hand, I return to the office minus keys, or the pen, or the notes. I am tired of looking for my keys. I am tired of putting down a good pen, and then when I miss it, spending 20 minutes hunting for it. I am tired of not having small change on me when I need it. I want equal pockets. Now, why do we not have pockets? Well, some would say that pockets, especially pockets that are used, bulge out and spoil the line of the skirt. But I wonder. I think having usable pockets, and especially putting one's hands in one's pockets, belongs to a category of behaviors like whistling and sitting with legs outstretched that society has labeled as too casual for women. Remember Jo in Little Women? When she would put her hands in her pockets and whistle, she scandalized her more proper sisters. But notice that whistling and pocketing her hands were natural acts, comfortable behaviors for Jo. She had to be brainwashed into the concept that they were unladylike. I wonder if putting one's hands in one's pockets may not be a subtle but clearly understood gesture of independence and cool detachment, the opposite of the overburdened Victorian woman struggling to board the tram and rendered very nearly helpless with all her paraphernalia. No wonder men leap to open doors for her. Walking unencumbered with hands either free or comfortably in pockets constitutes body language that society has traditionally considered too cocky for women. It is revealing to think a while about why casual, independent, or confident behavior was or is considered inappropriate. Happily, involvement in active sports and outdoor activities have taught women in past decades to value strenuous movement, comfortable clothes, shoes in particular, and confidence. And pockets. A visual stroll through the L.L. Bean catalog shows some of the handy places pockets turn up. In boots, knife pocket. In back of windbreakers, at knee level in fisherman's pants and overalls. Well, you get the idea. Do you think we could push manufacturers on the subject? Working pockets for working women or some rallying cry like that? I say working pockets because I've had too many close encounters with ornamental pockets that immediately fall to pieces from overuse, like holding a Kleenex or a paperclip. Oh, and before anyone reminds me, I know that some men are now carrying purses, though of course their tongues would rot in their mouths before they call them purses. All I can say is that they're welcome to them. Well, pockets are not the only target of discrimination. I feel strongly about whistling, as some of you know. And Salt Lake columnist Cliff Jolly escalated my sentiments on the subject and provoked me to write on the issue. A columnist for another Salt Lake City paper recently wrote a piece about my whistling. Admittedly, columnists get hard up for a subject matter occasionally. Mainly, he was surprised at my skill. After all, he wrote, women don't whistle. Now, the issue of women whistling or not whistling is hardly on the cutting edge of feminism. As the Earth orbits the sun and our planet moves ever closer to the second millennium, there are more significant matters facing us. Still, in defense of longtime women warblers and to preserve the territory available to any future whistlers, I'm going to offer these thoughts in rebuttal, but for equal consideration along with my colleagues' remarks. Let's get to the quick of the ulcer. My misguided friend said women don't whistle. Now that's false. He had the evidence of his own ears to prove otherwise. He had heard me whistling. So the don't obviously doesn't mean can't, as it might in the statement, dogs don't whistle. As further evidence, I have before me as I write a clipping from the Philadelphia Inquirer of July 15, 1982. This item shows the photograph of an 8-month-old infant whistling to the delight of the parents, Mr. and Mrs. Lewis Cohen. The baby, you will not be surprised to learn, is a girl. Clearly girls and women can whistle. Clearly they do whistle. Whistling is not a sex-linked skill. No, can't is not the issue here. Shouldn't is the real culprit. I had my showdown with this culprit before I wrote my age in two figures. Apparently, like the infant Carrie Cohen, I whistled precociously. I talked later than average and, alas, never learned to sing, but I whistled clearly and often from my crib. However, when I entered school, I first heard the couplet, so oft-cited to me now as to be definitely wearisome, whistling girls and crowing hens are sure to come to no good ends. Crowing is the prerogative of roosters, and by implication, whistling is the prerogative of male humans. Women, says society, should not whistle. Now, why has society in all its wisdom decreed against whistling for women? That question brings us into the realm of larger issues. Some say that the patriarchy has long decreed silence to be a woman's best state. Women like children were best seen and not heard. Literature is filled with male narrators who extol a woman's beauty and lament its desecration as soon as she speaks. A second explanation might be that society's nervousness comes up whenever women show too much vigor. Take more serious musical endeavors than whistling as an example. For years, women were discouraged from playing the visibly robust band and orchestra instruments, the trumpet, trombone, tuba, drums. Instead, they were guided toward the more ladylike choices, the flute, the harp, small strings, small woodwinds. It was this same brilliant reasoning that limited girls' basketball in my era to 2 dribbles at a time by any one player and no crossing the center line. Blessed Saint Martina. I have yet a third theory about whistling and women. Whistling is a casual, nonchalant activity. It gives a message of relaxed, informal unconcern about anything but the present moment. In that way, it's a bit like putting your hands in your pockets as you stroll. To most of us, walking with hands in pockets is a masculine bit of body language. But have you ever asked yourself, why? Well, theory aside, and despite society, some women have always whistled. I cannot give testimony about crowing hens. I'm sure I whistled so young because my grandmother, with whom we lived, filled her days with happy, busy whistling. While her hands worked away with a broom or pie dough or a heavy iron, Nanny's lips trilled merrily, melodiously. Her music was the background music of my childhood. A number of women nesting up in my family tree were career women of one sort or another, but Nanny was exclusively domestic. In her traditional home, I learned that whistling women meant coziness and good cheer. My mother whistled as well. When, as a school child, I was teasingly told the business about crowing hens, etc., I filed it away as more of the foolishness my father had warned me I would encounter in the world. He often quoted Puck, "What fools these mortals be." Incidentally, though whistling is still in my mind associated with jaunty independence of spirit, I have learned that it is not incompatible with elegance. One of the most elegant women I ever knew was a colleague of patrician slimness, beautiful carriage, exquisite wardrobe, and wonderful whistle. For clarity, melodiousness, and repertoire, she was unparalleled. Nowadays, out in Nevada, they hold an annual National Whistlers Contest with prizes offered in both women's and men's division. One of these fine days, I'm going to polish up my rendition of Sousa's Stars and Stripes Forever, or maybe The Happy Wanderer, and hitchhike over there, thumb up, and the other hand in my pocket, and a song on my lips. Care to join me? Before we get too far away from clothes, as a topic, I mean, I want to share my memoirs about a landmark item of women's clothing. Odd, isn't it, how our memories occasionally go blank on some of life's key moments. Search as I might, I can't remember a thing about the first time I put on a pair of pantyhose. I got thinking about that when I was mulling over the way our lives change behind our backs, so to speak. Whole cultural patterns fade and we aren't even aware of it. Somewhere during the past couple of decades, American womanhood made the shift from hosiery per se to pantyhose, and an entire way of life veered off in a new direction. But try as I might, I can't remember when it first happened to me. Knowing myself, I can conclude pretty definitely that it was going on for some time after the rest of the country had made the switch, but that doesn't help much. The thing is, there is such a cultural and connotative difference between hosiery, stockings, and pantyhose. Silk stockings. The very phrase has glamour. Why, they even made a movie with that title. And I used to say that a GI on leave in Europe during World War II could have a great time for himself with just a pair of nylons and a pack of cigarettes. In fact, if he were in Paris, he could get along without the cigarettes. And I remember that in Trenton, New Jersey, during the early 40s, if a store was lucky enough to get a shipment of nylons in, the mobs would match the New Year's Eve Times Square crowd for size. I was a child then, not even a teenager, and one of my chores was standing in line with ration books and the red and blue points to buy meat and sugar and other scarce foods. I was not yet one of those who would storm the local emporium in hopes of winning the prize of a pair of 15-gauge 50 denier, but I knew they were mighty important, and I assumed that when I was a woman, the nylon lust would rise within me and I would go forth ready to kill for my two lengths of gauze. Oh, unpredictable memory. As I was writing that last paragraph, that phrase, 15 gauge, 50 denier, raced to me from the corridors of the past. When was the last time you heard those words, and do you know what they mean? I never did. I just now looked up denier, a unit of fineness for rayon, nylon, and silk yarns based on a standard of 50 milligrams per 450 meter of yarn. A silk stocking, I am told, was frequently a cherished souvenir for men, a memento, the male version of a corsage crushed in the scrapbook. Can you imagine a man today treasuring a pair of pantyhose? Putting on your first pair of hose and heels, the words went together, hose and heels. Dress for a dance was specified as hose and heels. Putting on your first pair constituted a rite of passage, an initiation act at least as significant as a boy's first shave. I can remember with great vividness sitting with my friend Carol in the living room while she held the top of her outflung first stocking, extending her leg and preparing to draw the stocking on as she would a hip boot. If you got the hose on successfully without starting the dreaded run, you then launched into the session with the heels, an experience similar in many ways to learning to ride a bike, except with the shoes we had no training wheels, although we surely could have used them. This whole transformation had its sad side, to which I'm even now not fully reconciled. To take a free young girl, free running, who has known the joy of the earth under her feet and who has operated her body with speed, dexterity, and confidence, and to shackle her that she can only teeter and totter and mince and clop woodenly, how far removed is that from foot binding? If the feet were the only things involved, it wouldn't have been so bad, but I remember the day when my mother decided I had to wear a suit to school, complete with girdle. Now, in the first place, I went to the Country Mouse High School, not the city school. My classmates and I were definitely lower middle class. The tailored forest green suit that my mother sent me off in that day was as exotic in that time and place as a muumuu would have been. Of course, everyone asked me why I was so dressed up. I think I invented a story about having an interview after school. More than likely, I probably just mumbled. I wasn't as good at social lies then. Far worse than the question was the girdle. Now, I don't know how it happened, but I must have worn that suit and girdle with bobby socks and saddle shoes, because I know for a fact that nothing anchored the girdle. It was not a panty girdle. I did not, in other words, have nylons hooked to the girdle. By noon, the girdle had rolled itself neatly up on my bottom and was clamped around my midsection like a life preserver. I was suffocating, physically, emotionally, psychologically. It felt as if I were playing host to a powerful and affectionate python. I wish I remember the details of giving up girdle and hose. All I know is that suddenly my problem involved finding out from the underground where we full-figured gals, as Jane Russell coyly called us, could get pantyhose that fit. My particular problem is not getting something big enough to go around me. It's that the hose quits and the panty begins before I do, if you see what I mean. Wearing an item like that is exactly like having yourself encased in a nice bandage from the knees up. It is not conducive to sprinting across Salt Lake City's wide streets before the lights change. By the time I do find pantyhose that fit, color is so unimportant I rarely even consider it unless it's white. You know, a favorite hosiery color is taupe. Honestly, now, do you know what color taupe is? Quote, brownish gray to darkish yellowish brown. No wonder they call it taupe. As we close in on the magic year 2000, people are giving especially eager attention to what the next century and millennium holds and whether we are closer or further away from the Orwellian nightmare vision. I have very little clear picture of what our world will be in 50 or 100 years politically, economically, ecologically. But optimist that I am convinced that if we last that long, someone will have devised an improvement on pantyhose. I mean, surely, if we can put Sally Ride on the moon, we can give her, well, you get my point. Bottoms up. I got a little nostalgic there. And unfortunately, nostalgia isn't what it used to be. But one aspect never fails to get me salivating. Nostalgia food. I've been thinking about it quite a while. Nostalgia food is food with which we have rich and cherished associations to the point that the food takes on an aura quite separate from its objective reality. I first learned about nostalgia food when I traveled to Wales, home of my father's ancestors, and tasted the poor man's cake about which my father had raved for years. Well, poor man's cake is just what its honest title suggests, a make-do dish that barely qualifies as a dessert at all. Why, then, had my father carried on about it throughout my childhood? Simply because it was a staple of his childhood, of those times when a growing boy's appetite provided the tangy sauce for any dish, and because his adoring mother made it for him. His memories had virtually nothing to do with the austere ingredients of the humble cake itself. Nostalgia food from the Intermountain region, according to the people who have fessed up to me, includes lettuce and milk. Lettuce crumbled in a bowl, sprinkled with sugar and doused in milk. Cake and milk, same scenario, with canned fruit added if available. And of course, the honored Mormon tradition, bread and milk. As for my own family, I was in college before I realized that many people never ate lettuce sandwiches, just lettuce and mayonnaise on bread. We also poured ketchup in a saucer and dipped bread into it. Likewise, I regret to say, syrup and bread. But the real nostalgia food of my childhood was huckleberries. Huckleberries and blueberries are first cousins, same family but different genus. One of the earliest memories of my life centers on cool summer mornings in northern Pennsylvania before the sun had warmed the day, when a swarthy woman known only as Huckleberry Mary came sauntering through the alleys of our childhood calling out that wonderful chant, Huckleberries! On her head, she balanced a large dishpan filled with berries she and her children had picked before sunrise that day. My grandmother would give me a peck measure, and I'd go out and get our morning supply. The deep purple berries were rimmed in cold water, covered with milk, not today's 1% or even 2%, and sugar. and slowly, almost meditatively consumed. You could put them on cereal, of course, or in muffins or pancakes, but to me, such arrangements always obscured the point, which was the plump, perfect berries themselves. No fruit I know of is plumper than a ripe huckleberry. You might almost be tempted to call it overinflated. To feel the berries burst on your tongue and yield up their sweetness, that was a pleasure that never lost its delight. Now, in actuality, huckleberries have a rather, what shall I say, that will be honest without being disloyal, a simple flavor. I know that objectively strawberries and peaches and other fruits are more impressive, but beauty is in the taste buds of the beholder, so to speak. The other day at Albertson's, I saw cups of blueberries for sale. Not quite huckleberries, but family is family. I took them home, washed them lovingly, and poured on some half and half. I expected a degree of disappointment, but no. Suddenly I was 5 years old again, and the morning was cool, the world was fresh, and Huckleberry Mary's street chant was strong and as alluring as ever, unmuffled by time's long corridor. Of course, we all get nostalgic about music as well as food. Certain songs just transport you right back to the past more effectively than a time travel machine, don't they? The group that carries the most emotional weight of that sort for me is the great trio of Peter, Paul, and Mary. For years, along with a great many of you, I have loved Peter, Paul, and Mary. I loved them so much that once, 2 decades ago, I started to write a short story in which their music figured prominently in the climax. I always assumed I knew why PP&M got to me, but at a recent Together Again at Last concert, I discovered something I must have known only intuitively before. Of course, we all turned on those 20-plus years ago to the great energy the trio projected. We felt the hammer in our own hands. We knew that we were the answer blowing so urgently in the wind. We marveled at Paul's unearthly ability to produce sound effects. Planes, motorcycles, squeaking doors, quicksand, all of it. Who could stay calm when the three of them headed into the final chorus of "Don't Go Down to the Quarry"? Who could doubt that Mary was blasting off when she told us she was leaving on that jet plane? The sheer vigor and zest of this threesome shot over the footlights to those of us who had so recently been called, and rightly, the silent generation, and it was enough to win lifelong groupies. And of course, the music itself, the songs that reached down into our consciousness and shook the cobwebs from our priorities, that was what made everything else work and still does. Hearing them today singing about El Salvador is like getting a blood transfusion when you need it most. But watching them this time, I saw something I had not understood before. Maybe everyone else saw it from the beginning. What impressed me was the lovely, the affirming, androgynous quality of the group. Notice the two men often framing Mary like a pair of asymmetrical bookends. There's Paul, that long, graceful expanse bending at the knee, always bending, his body yielding and almost seeming to mold the music that produced among them. On the opposite side is Peter, curving, bending, not at the knee, but from the upper back. Watch them as they cradle their guitars, tenderly, lovingly stroking and caressing them into response. Listen to their gentle, strong voices, Peter singing to the muffins, as he calls children. Will it help if I stay very near? I am here. And of course, Puff always was Peter's song in a very particular way. Here, all those long years ago, in the days when Macho was king, were two very manly men with soft voices, nurturing hearts, and gentle ways. And Mary! Watch Mary as she physically dominates the group. Paul says in his patter to the audience that he doesn't know whether to classify her as one of his best friends or his den mother. Here is and always was a woman who planted her feet far apart, threw her arms out with the amplitude of a male dancer, showed off those incredibly wide, square shoulders, and belted forth the songs without a by-year leave from anyone. How proudly she tosses that leonine mane. Hers is the voice that always carries, always grounds the others. Hers is the voice with the husky edge, the tweed texture. And we remember her best for the fortissimo songs, "Close Your Eyes and Listen to If I Had a Hammer Again." Whose voice is it that you hear? And with all the vigor, assertion, strength, and leadership, no one who sees her ever doubts for an eighth note her essential womanhood. She is one of those females who are a woman with a capital W. Well, that's my theory anyway. All those years ago, and all the years since, in addition to the messages of their folk songs, Mary asserts that there never was a Republican folk singer, PP&M have been telling us what we are now trying so hard to teach each other, that strong men can be gentle and nurturing and tender, and that lovely women can be strong and bold and proud. Maybe that's one reason Peter, Paul, and Mary don't seem dated, at least to this admiring groupie. You know, nostalgia gets to be important as you reach the prime of life. Ah, the prime. In case you're not sure what constitutes the prime, I'll clarify the matter. The prime of life is 1 year older than whatever age you are at present. And it is, as some of you know, a time bristling with ironies. There are some things they don't tell you about the prime of life. You can call it middle age if you want. I prefer the prime. Oh, they tell you about some of the little jolts. Who hasn't heard about hot flashes and bifocals? But they neglect to tell you about the age group epidemic. Babies have colic, kids have chicken pox, teens have acne, and those of us in the prime of life have... Well, let me put it this way. Do you remember the Alan Alda movie, Four Seasons? Now, who did I identify with in that movie? Witty Carol Burnett? No. Volatile, feisty Rita I'm Italian Moreno? No. Skipping right over the blonde beauty played by Bess Armstrong, we come to compassionate, intense Alan Alda himself. But no, I didn't even identify with him. Actually, the only person in the whole cast who fascinated me was Jack Weston playing Danny, the resident hypochondriac. I hung on his funny, chilling speeches as though mesmerized. It was as though he had eavesdropped on my phone conversations. Since the prime began to loom before me, strange things have started happening. The Reader's Digest, stacked unavoidably before me in the checkout line at the grocery store, shout headlines about a new disease every month. The Digest is unfailingly cheerful, I'll say that for them. The last title I glanced at raved, New Hope for the Dead. But just that litany of diseases, month after month, makes the Digest optimism a little like a mortician's. Every time the doorbell rings, it's one of my neighbors collecting for the disease of the month. Last week, Mary Kay Pierce came by soliciting donations for Snyde syndrome. I asked about it and discovered it's a rare disease of the hair that affects only the second-born sons of Serbo-Croatian parents who are both left-handed. I gave $5. I know my parents claimed they were Welsh, but you can't be too careful. Whenever I flip on the TV, the picture invariably shows either a live human heart beating away while six doctors perform a quadruple bypass, or a documentary explaining what a huge black market there is for healthy human hearts, and how many people have been showing up at the coroner's with an unexplainable cavity in their chests. Telephone conversations with good friends take one of two tacks. Can you top this, or what's good for? Can you top this is a duet for alto and soprano, a melodramatic recital of symptoms. No, it didn't break the skin, but the rash has been there for 3 days, and I can only raise my left arm halfway over my head. Your knee is doing what? Did you say your nose is aching? How can your nose ache, Gretchen? Do you mean your sinuses? Okay, your nose then. What's good for is based on the established truth that doctors, especially doctors who are not yet in the prime of life, don't know everything, right? And if we don't look out for ourselves, who will? What's good for is the password to the underground pharmacological network. That's right, 2 teaspoons of cayenne pepper, 1 tablespoon of honey, 2 mashed aspirin, 1 jigger of B&B, and 1 cup of boiling water. Well, all I know is that Frank's mother swears by it and she never misses a day of golf. Now, after all these years and all the bad-mouthing about old wives' tales, the Guess What We've Discovered boys have come out and brazenly vindicated chicken soup and hot milk after all. Chicken soup is really supposed to do something for colds and hot milk for insomnia. A $200,000 government grant some nice beardless youth got to prove what his mother and her sisters had known for nothing. Your body will also pick this time to have its own identity crisis, let me warn you. You've eaten hamburgers since before the Golden Arches ever existed, right? Suddenly, as you ease into the prime, you'll discover your stomach will no longer have anything to do with hamburgers, or pizza after 6 p.m., or cola drinks after 12 noon, or serious adult mustard. Last night, my sweet tooth was acting up. But sweets are bad, of course. I heard that sometimes eating a dill pickle will satisfy the cravings for sugar. Just as I reached for a dill, I remembered that pickles are loaded with salt, very bad for blood pressure. What about a small chunk of cheese? Cholesterol. A little tuna fish. But didn't the 6 o'clock news warn about some cans of tuna fish that were being recalled because of contamination? Sorry, I can't come to work. I have a touch of botulism. Maybe I'll just have a slice of dry toast. Wait a minute. Is that asbestos lining the toaster? Move over, Danny. Of course, if you're living life in the fast lane, or even in the middle lane, sleep is important. I had my golden birthday recently, the big 5-0. For some reason, birthdays don't depress me. I seem to have an oriental perspective on age. I consider each passing year as another notch on my belt. And of course, that may literally be true, but we won't talk about expansion here. I go around announcing my age the way other women in my actuarial group announce new grandchildren. That habit does not endear me to my old classmates who resent my spilling the collective beans, but that's their problem. It seems fitting to commemorate the half-century mark with some kind of manifesto, so here's my manifesto at 50. I herewith declare my emancipation from other people's asceticism, especially in regard to sleep. People in this culture seem to be in a perpetual contest to see who can sleep the least. I have many friends whose regular bedtime is 2 or 3 a.m., which wouldn't be so objectionable if they were dancing or stargazing or otherwise burning a party candle. But no, these folks are up in the night cleaning out basements for contributions to Deseret Industries and baking zucchini pretzels. Of course, folks who knowingly plant zucchini deserve to lose sleep over it. And these same folks boast of arising at an unmentionable hour. When I was on a high-powered committee a while back, several women said to me on different occasions, "If you need to reach me, call any time before 7 in the morning." 5 is apparently the hour that puts you in the diligent but not neurotic pack. 6 is acceptable but not worth mentioning. 7 is undisciplined, and 8, of course, is pure tight-lipped sloth. Look, may I be frank, I consider that kind of schedule in the same category as foot binding. I have read, impelled by guilt, of course, many, many studies on the matter indicating that most healthy adults, if left free of the bizarre restrictions of self-denial and nocturnal stay-upmanship, will sleep between 7 and 8 hours a night. If nature has set our inner alarm clocks for an 8-hour tryst with the Sandman, what kind of masochism seeks to cut short the night? Sleep is non-fattening. It produces no cholesterol. It doesn't pollute the atmosphere or consume the lungs. It doesn't result in hangovers or smashed vehicles. So why the guilt? It used to be that if someone telephoned and found you a bit groggy at your end, she would say apologetically, "Oh, I'm so sorry, were you sleeping?" The gaffe was hers, not yours. Now if someone says, "Were you sleeping?" it usually comes through as an indictment, an accusation, and you have to tap dance and say, "No, no, I just got a frog in my throat, a touch of the croup. Who, me, sleep? How dare you even suggest such a thing?" I know astonishingly few women who would allow themselves to spend an hour comfortably relaxing in a hammock, let alone sleeping in one. Now, I'm going to crawl way out on a limb here, but I'll stick by my precarious position. I don't think the female sex will produce our quota of great philosophers until more of us learn the uses of a hammock and idleness and creative sleep. One last study to ponder. Extensive research on people who've had long, healthy lives, 90 years plus, failed to come up with any constant common denominator. The very old include drinkers and non-drinkers, smokers and non-smokers, city folk and farmers, meat eaters and vegetarians, on and on. No single constant. And then some researcher asked the right question. And by overwhelming numbers, the figures showed that virtually all of those who lived long and prospered had, throughout their entire lives, slept well and soundly for 7 to 8 hours. So if you belong to the sleep is just a weakness that can be overdone, set, count me out. If you're on a 90-calorie diet and a 4-hour sleep regime, look for applause elsewhere. And if you phone me and I sound newly wakened, hang up softly. I'll recycle newspapers and use unleaded gas and conserve water, and I've never even considered buying anything made of animal fur. But folks, I am going to keep regular hours with that healing old Sandman. And who knows, maybe by the time my next birthday flips up on the calendar, I'll be on the Phil Donahue defending my controversial new book, Sleep Without Guilt. Night all. We may get away with some dirty tricks on Mother Earth, but Mother Nature has the last laugh on us, especially when we reach the prime of life. Great baseball player Satchel Paige used to say, "After 40, it's just patch, patch, patch." The body begins to erode a little around the edges, and we end up spending a lot more time than we had planned doing maintenance and repair chores on ourselves. Recently, I spent part of a day in the hospital for minor surgery. Actually, the word minor is a bit exaggerated for what I had done. I'm not convinced the doctor could have taken care of everything quite nicely in his office waiting room, or maybe in the front seat of my car with the engine idling. Nevertheless, it was an experience. First of all, to make sure it wasn't too much of an experience, I extracted a promise from the doctor. Now, have you encountered afterburn in your own life? Afterburn is a principle whereby you spend 4 hours, for example, cleaning up the mess your kids made preparing a Mother's Day breakfast, which you ate in 7 minutes. Afterburn is what can make a weekend vacation a week-long misery if you have mountains of laundry, 2 cases of second-degree sunburn, 1 case of poison ivy, 1 cold, and 4 overextended credit cards to cope with after the vacation. Bearing that in mind, I carefully made the MD swear that there would not be any ritual shaving in preparation for my little encounter with the knife. I was not about to undergo a 5-minute operation followed by 6 weeks of rash, itching, and general misery. After all, I told the doctor, if you were going to remove a man's tonsils, you would not routinely shave his mustache, would you? We negotiated and he agreed, and I thought I was safe, but I was wrong. I had forgotten the tests. After the initial arrangements are made, patients don't get to just go home and gnaw their nails until the big day. No siree. They have to have tests. Modern American medicine is founded on tests. It's the medical profession's way of carrying on the tradition of multiple choice from school days. Only now they play the game by giving tests instead of taking them, but the object seems to be about the same. And if you haven't played tests recently, you're in for a surprise. Between them, the MDs and the technologists, hereafter known as they, have come up with tests that are rare feats of the imagination. For example, they have one test whereby they can take a picture of your innards without using X-ray or fluoroscope. I think it's done with sound waves. And they use it frequently to check the condition of the unborn baby and pregnant women. Of course, I hope I don't have to say that that was not the purpose in my case. I would have been thrilled if it were, though. One problem with this gadget is that sometimes the patient's bladder gets in the way of what they really want to see. So to get the bladder up and out of the line of fire, they force you to drink several drums of water. Now, you may think that you ordinarily drink a lot anyway, but whatever you customarily drink is just a piddling amount, so to speak, compared with what these technicians are determined to get down you. Then when they have filled you up to the proper level, they strip you naked, toss you a wisp of a gown as a nod in modesty's direction, and shuffle you out into a public corridor to wait. There you are, 5 or 10 of you, with bare bums held by the force of suction in uncomfortable scoop-bottom chairs, all pretending to be engrossed in the Days of Our Lives, which is blaring forth from its perch near the ceiling. Meanwhile, the days of your own life are going by all too slowly, and you soon have a feeling that your very lungs are afloat. In half an hour or so, you're called into the dark sanctorum to have your abdomen scanned with a little implement attached to a huge machine that looks more like a metal detector than a medical instrument. Slowly, slowly, the two women operating the machine sound your depths, taking their time with occasional breaks to consult each other about what the cafeteria may be offering for lunch that day. When at last you are finished, you're still not finished. Relief is not yet at hand or anywhere else. The technicians have to take the computer printout to the radiologist to see if all went well or whether take two is necessary. So you sit some more, your legs crossed in at least 3 places. At last, test verified, you are ushered into a little restroom that by this time has assumed the aura of paradise. There's another test you'll want to check into someday. This one takes about 12 hours, all told. It begins the night before when you stop eating or drinking. No gum, no knife savers, no diet drinks, nothing, their advanced woman spells out on the phone. You ask if it's all right to swallow. Next morning at 8 at the lab, they want to draw your blood. Now, my family physician used to have a nurse called Gondola or Granola or some other wonderful Mormon name. Whatever her name, she could zero in on a vein in my arm, shoot the needle in, draw blood, be back at the desk, yelling at the insurance company on the phone, all in one revolution of the second hand on the old wall clock. Since her retirement, subsequent nurses have acted as if I were deliberately hiding my veins on them. I will spare you what I have gone through trying to give them a small sample of blood. I swear I'm going to have the place tattooed with a caption reading, siphon here. Anyway, at 8 a.m., a tall, skinny boy plays hide-and-seek for a while, finds the vein, and draws blood. Then he gives me something to drink, 3 ounces of a liquid that causes my toes to clench. He gives me another 3-ounce cup and asks for a urine sample. I will also spare you the instructions printed on a sign in the bathroom telling you how to get the sample. All that I can say is that it does not seem like an operation for a person with only 2 hands. Emerging moderately successful, I place the tiny damp cup on a counter where unseen hands later whisk it away for analysis. That's all there is to this test, except that these steps are repeated 4 times every hour on the hour. I sleep in the car in the parking lot some of the time, read some of the time. Each time I re-enter the hospital lab, a different young person is there to bleed me. Perhaps it is also a test for them. Perhaps they are drawing straws behind the counter. Who knows? Maybe it's their way of relieving the monotony for me. By noon, I have spent longer at this than I will spend in the hospital on the day of the operation. On that day, incidentally, I'm told to bring a specimen. That's the euphemism. So universally accepted is it that you're never told a specimen of what? Now, a great many women bring in specimens, and they seem to have a pantry full of empty baby food jars to use, just the right size, not me. I searched and searched for something, but all I could find was a quart canning jar. That is, if you discount some smaller vases. Somehow, I really didn't think they'd appreciate my depositing a bud vase on their counter. When I gave the nurse the bottle as I checked in, she looked at it about 4/5 full and said dryly, "We only need a small specimen. Just what did you think we were going to do with it anyway? This is not like the blood bank." Before very long, I am wheeled in a bed to a holding area. This is it. The real thing. Doctors, nurses, orderlies, aides. They're all coming and going. I strain my ears. I keep my eyes alert. After all, I'm no green kid. I know what goes on in places like this. I watch General Hospital, St. Elsewhere. Why, I can go back a lot further than that. I remember Joyce Jordan, MD, and young Dr. Malone on radio. I know the passion that seethes beneath those crisp white uniforms. I know of the triangles, the trysts, the temptations. That's when the great revelation comes. I listen, and I eavesdrop, and you know what? It's not General Hospital. It's the local supermarket, so help me. Everybody is talking about when they're going to take their break. And who will take the afternoon shift for whom 3 weeks from yesterday? I'm in the holding tank or whatever for about an hour before and after, and that's all I hear, word of honor. Of course, the doctor's not talking about his break. He's talking about his vacation, which apparently begins as soon as I come out of the anesthetic and can tell him how many thumbs he has on his right hand. I am home by 1 o'clock, just in time to see if they've discovered a cure for Diana's amnesia. And if Brad has found out that his baby is not dead. I notice they're sending Joe in for some tests. Well, that takes care of him until Christmas. Now, I've been talking about ironies and paradoxes and ambivalences. And I think no other season of the year is richer with paradox and irony than Christmas. Here are a few thoughts on staying green. Oh, Tannenbaum, a tree by any other name would smell as paradoxical. Perhaps no tangible trapping of Christmas can equal the tree in generating ambivalence. To begin with, if you are genetically of the breed that observes Christmas at all, you must have a tree. Many folks have wondered in the privacy of their post-Thanksgiving picking on the turkey bones if they couldn't merely forego the tree this year, just for a change, just to simplify things a bit. Well, those who have tried it report that it is, in fact, simpler to have the tree in all its complexity than to explain over and over again to all and sundry why you don't have one. A certain quite affluent family of my acquaintance staunchly resisted being treed one Yule, only to discover on Christmas Eve a fully decorated tree on their porch, along with a cardboard box of groceries and an assortment of dime store toys for the children. Charity may never fail, but her eyesight can blur from time to time, especially if a tree is not in sight. Long married couples who have finally nudged the last fledgling out of the nest sometimes think, now this year we don't need to have a tree. Wrong. Word will spread quicker than spilled milk from Fresno to Philadelphia. The folks aren't having a tree this year. However inappropriate, pity will well up, then guilt. And before long, the good couple will have not only a donated tree, but all of the chicks back in their laps, determined that the folks won't have a lonely, treeless holiday. Of course, all chicks will disperse before the time to take down the tree and vacuum up the needles. Ambivalence lingers even in households quite dedicated to trees. Take my friends Jean and Elaine. Jean likes big, full, bushy trees, robust, hardy specimen, whose vigor and pungency reminds her of the forests on a starlit night. Elaine, for reasons known only to her analysts, always searches for a spindly little orphan of a tree, one that she can rescue, bring in out of the cold, turn into a Cinderella princess with baubles and bangles and a veil of tinsel. After several years of unsatisfactory compromise, resulting in two martyrs where only one was needed, Jean and Elaine now solve their problem by alternating. 1 year, a big Ethel Merman of a tree that dominates not only the room but the house and most of the block. The next year, a quirky little Meg Tilly that has to be coaxed to stand up straight in its metal base. Friends Polly and Roger have a different ambivalence to deal with. They solved the problem of choosing a tree some time ago. They brought a fine artificial model. But 2 years ago, Roger fumed amid a snarl of wires and bulbs. I'm not going to put the lights on and off this tree one more time. So now, on New Year's Eve, Polly and Roger shroud their tree, lights, decorations, and all, in a large green garbage bag and put the whole thing downstairs. The following year, they whip off the cover and behold, instant tree. Yes, the whole subject of the tree is draped thick with ambivalence. Use the old decorations, worn ragged with tradition, or toss them all out and start fresh. Put the tree right up after Thanksgiving and enjoy it all month, or spring it full-blown on the children on Christmas morn. Go the whole distance with a tree that scrapes the ceiling and crowds out the couch and two relatives, or prudently settle for one that perches atop the TV and seems forever an afterthought. Well, maybe the tree is a compromise after all, and a paradox. In the quiescent season of the year at winter solstice, we bring into our homes the tree that is evergreen to remind us of spring's promise. In the darkest days, we light strings of colored bulbs and candles and fires to cheer ourselves and our neighbors on our way. These lights are not, after all, the summer sun. And the tree hauled down from Oregon or assembled in a factory in Taiwan is not, after all, a crocus or a shimmering aspen alive on the hillsides. But neither are we quite ever what we would like to be, ever quite what the promise said we could be. Yet that doesn't ultimately matter. I think what matters is that we keep on, December after December, wrestling good-naturedly with the tree, and that whether in observance of Christmas or solstice or Hanukkah or our own inner season, we keep on lighting candles amid the darkness. Thank you very much.
This concludes Eloise Bell's talk, Only When I Laugh. For a list of other tapes in the Aspen Audio Library, write to Aspen Books, P.O. Box 21055, Salt Lake City, Utah, 84121.